Hello, I'm Eric Ulrich.
And I'm Mick Mulroy.
Welcome to LoboCast, a product of the Lobo Institute. Our goal is to deliver a discussion on topics surrounding or related to conflict in ways that not only explore the issue, but explore potential solutions.
Lobo Institute is a conflict resolution consultancy based in Northwest Montana. We advise, consult, and teach on current and future conflicts, how to end those conflicts and prevent their recurrence, and how to help those most affected.
The views of the host and guest expressed in this LoboCast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Institute.
We hope you enjoy this episode. Over to this week's host.
I'm Liam McHugh, hosting with Walton Mulroy. Today we have the incredible honor of speaking with Colonel John D. Duke, a distinguished Marine Corps officer. Aside from his long list of notable accomplishments, we will be focusing our discussion on his tour commanding U.S. Special Operations in Central Africa, supporting African partners in counterinsurgency operations against Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army during Operation Observant Compass.
All right, sir. So I'd just like to start off by saying it's an absolute pleasure to have you here with us today. We do have a few questions for you that it will be going in between Liam and myself. So the first question I have for you, sir, is could you explain the civil war in Uganda prior to the U.S. involvement?
Well, the LRA story, it's very complicated, and it's rooted in the Ugandan civil wars of the 1980s that fractured the former British colony along ethnic lines largely. The LRA, composed of the Acholi ethnic minority of northern Uganda, emerged from this tumultuous period in the 80s. And by the time the U.S. became involved, the LRA had been adopted by the Sudanese regime as a surrogate against the Museveni government in Uganda in the constant jostling of Central African states for power and influence.
And could you describe to me how that came into be with the mission for Operation Observant Compass?
So the Ugandans had prosecuted operations against the LRA into the 90s and through the 90s into the early 2000s. With largely great success in removing them as a threat from northern Uganda. The peace talks of 2006 arranged for the LRA to move far to the west, largely in the Garamba Park area of northeastern DRC. And they continue to prosecute operations against the LRA there, but they weren't effective in defeating the LRA. And so the LRA continued to conduct attacks on the communities in eastern DRC, eastern Central African Republic, South Sudan, and northern Uganda. So at the time, you may remember, around 2012, there was a very popular movie called Kony 2012, in which the LRA predations upon these Central African communities was widely popularized in America. And that produced support, or the people of the United States petitioned their government, as we have the freedom to do, to do something about that, for American assistance to the Central African states that were fighting the LRA. So the mission for Operation Observant Compass that we received was to provide intelligence, logistics, and training support to African Union forces assigned to defeat the LRA. Our mission wasn't to bring an American solution to the LRA problem, but to actually help the Africans defeat the LRA themselves.
Thank you, sir. Could you talk a little bit about how Operation Observant Compass evolved over the course of the mission and what role you played in the mission?
Sure. Operation Observant Compass was an effort begun by the Obama administration after the movie we spoke about. And from its inception, it was intended to be a small footprint operation executed by U.S. Africa Command, which whose headquarters is in Stuttgart, Germany, but is responsible for the African continent for American military operations and interests in the African continent. And it was envisioned to be a small nucleus of a U.S. Army Special Forces company, or an AOB, Advanced Operating Base, and designated logistics and combat support capabilities attached. The mission eventually evolved to include 300 or so personnel from all four services, and Special Operations Command Africa, or SOC Africa, as it's known in military speak, served as the higher headquarters of what became a Special Operations Task Force on the continent. Our headquarters was located in Entebbe, Uganda, and we had forward operating bases, or FOBs, in three neighboring countries: South Sudan, Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I was privileged to serve as the commanding officer for Operation Observant Compass from spring 2014 to spring 2015.
So you had a very high up role in this mission. So how did prior experiences help you with some of the decisions you made during Operation Observant Compass?
Well, by the time I commanded OOC, I had spent 5 years of my career deployed or stationed in Africa and the Middle East. Much of this time was spent in austere locations, operating with partners and allies, often conducting operations or engagements in their language, and conducting both military and diplomatic activities from the tactical to the policy level of government. I had also commanded a Marine Special Operations Battalion where I led and trained Marines and sailors in these operations. So all of these experiences gave me the tools that I needed to execute the OOC mission.
Yeah, that's remarkable, sir. And then could you explain with that prior experience how you were able to deploy your forces in that main effort?
Well, as I said, our headquarters was in Entebbe, and we operated 3 FOBs in 3 other countries. Now, these were very austere FOBs in the bush, as they say. They were accessible primarily by air, and they were near our African partners' operating bases or camps themselves. To give you some sense of the scale of the battle space or the area of operations, our AO, or area of operations, was the size of California. And I need to say, Americans particularly, or those who have not been to Africa, are really unfamiliar with the scale and size of that continent. And so you see these lines on a map, you really have to study and come to grips with the proportions. Just as an example, the country of Sudan prior to the separation of South Sudan from the North, the country of Sudan itself is the same size as the United States from the Canadian border to the Mexican border and from the eastern border of the state of Colorado to the West Coast. That's just the country of Sudan. So we had a very large area of operations. And our main effort was to enable the African Union Regional Task Force to find and defeat the LRA in that territory. And we did this through a mixture of intelligence and logistics support operations that kept them, the African forces, on the hunt and in the field. But we also supported them with military information support capabilities that served two purposes. One was it mobilized the local communities under the threat of the LRA attack to support the African Union forces and their operations. And two, it also messaged directly to LRA members the futility of continued fighting and running. And also it provided them insight and information on the different surrender options offered to LRA members by the African Union governments, specifically the Ugandan government.
Sir, I really like that you pointed out the size because having lived there myself, coming back to the United States or even Europe, Africa is just Africa. There's not like they don't talk about the 54 countries and just the sheer size. I knew about Sudan being as large as it was, being bigger than like all of Western Europe combined. So it's very good to, like, when you talk about where your area of operation is, that is the sheer size to find an individual in the and the same size of California is. It's not easy. I have no doubt.
No, Walton, you know, the important thing, and we can talk about this perhaps, more later if you want, but specifically regarding logistics, when we talk about how do you provision a force and sustain a force in a operating base or in an operating area that's of such expanse, and particularly with the use of aircraft who consume massive amounts of fuel. We frequently found that to move fuel into the bush so that we could extend the reach of our forces and the African Union forces particularly, we had to burn a barrel of gas just to move a barrel of gas. Wow. And so with some of our air platforms and then others, we can move two barrels on one barrel of gas. That becomes a huge logistics challenge over when you spread it out over the expanse that Africa is.
Wow. So what kind of techniques and tactics did you use to try to get that? Because I understand that the infrastructure out there is not very well. From that area of operation, I'm sure you have between desert to absolute dense jungle. So what techniques and tactics did you find most effective?
So in terms of the support and achieving the level of support we needed, some of it we just relied on the use of road networks that no one in the West would ever imagine were trafficable. And it would, it could take as long as 6 weeks for a convoy to leave the border, western border of Uganda, and reach our base, for example, in Obo, Central African Republic, depending on the time of the year. And, you know, we struggled sometimes to create, to explain to those off the continent or not in our not with us, the difficulties with logistics, because they just had never seen conditions so poor. And when they looked at the maps that they were provided and they were trying to help us plan logistics, they would say, well, you have this road that runs, through Western Uganda into Eastern DRC. It shows it runs right up into Obo. And I would explain to them, no, that's not a road. That's a riverbed. And it's there's a river running down it half the year. So in terms of logistics, we relied primarily on aircraft and then just long-term logistics convoys to bring the fuel, particularly for foodstuffs and medical supplies and ammunition and medical equipment and other military equipment. We relied primarily though on aviation. And I had under my command about 16 aircraft, a mixture of rotary wing and fixed wing support aircraft to deliver both long-term logistics as well as combat logistics to resupply African forces while they were on patrol or in contact. Some of the other techniques and tactics we used to be effective out there, though, beyond logistics was I've already hinted at our military information support operations capability from 4th Psychological Operations Group out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They brought a tremendous capability and improved really to be the decisive arm of battle, if you will, against the LRA by, once again, trying to convince the LRA to give up and members of the LRA to defect. And then by mobilizing and informing local communities about LRA activities and helping them connect with each other, actually, to understand the threat and to be able to mobilize security forces in their own village security to try to be aware of what was going on around them. We also provided a lot of training support to the AU forces. I had, as I said, a special forces company inside our command, and we had those ODAs, the Operation Detachment Alphas, the teams of Green Berets that were out in the bush living with the partner forces. They trained those forces in patrol techniques, in medical care and trauma care for themselves and for their communities around them. They trained them in the employment of both small arms and crew-served weapons. And also, by the way, and very importantly, they trained them in human rights and in laws of armed conflict, because, you know, we wanted to ensure that there was a common understanding between all the partners that we were out there to do good in defeating the LRA, not just to defeat them tactically. And then one of the other tools that I think we brought to this challenge is that just the presence of U.S. forces alongside the African Union bolstered the legitimacy of the whole coalition out there. The African communities had this sense that, yes, they were struggling with it, their governments were struggling with it, but also that it had become a struggle of international cooperation, and there were many different actors out there who were trying to help them rid themselves of this scourge of the LRA.
So that kind of makes me ask the question, how did they take to that? So did they find it that they're seeing these Americans in their military uniforms? Are they looking at them thinking like these people are here to help, like they're on our side, like we have more compassion or affection towards these people? Or did they kind of see it as overstepping, or did they not want us there at all?
So on the local community level, we all got along and we were very well received. Wherever we went, we found the local communities very receptive. I think there's a sense of when they think of the United States, they think of the United States as a stable government that promotes democracy and human rights abroad, that comes with good intentions of helping them improve their own condition tangibly, and that we have the power and the tools to do that. And we were very well received on the local level. You know, Central Africa has a very complex history in terms of colonialism. And so we worked very hard to assure our African partners that far from the legacy of colonialism and any sense of exploitation, the United States was not there for that purpose, to try to, you know, convince any skeptics that we were there for the sole purpose of helping them defeat Joseph Kony and not to get involved in any other activities such as changing local governments. You may recall, if we're around the time I was there in 2014 and 15, the year previous or prior to that had been the Arab Spring. And so there were 11, 12, 13. And so I arrived in Central Africa at a time right as the first wave of the Arab Spring revolutions was coming to conclusion. And there was a lot of unrest. The ISIS in Syria had begun to take root and to expand. And so I think on the part of some of the African governments, there was perhaps a suspicion that maybe the United States was here to, you know, to promote an African Spring. And of course, that couldn't have been further from the truth. There were some other things in policy-wise that was going on between some of our African partners and the United States government on policy matters of law and human rights. And so that complicated our operations. But we worked really hard with our African commanders to insulate OOC from those other issues and to try to focus on where our common ground lay, and that was in defeating the LRA.
Well, that's really good to hear that on the local level, you are welcome with open arms and seen as a benefit rather than an exploiter. So, but on that note, how was the government's view of you guys? Were you seen as not being there for the right reasons, or you had other means or other causes for being there rather than the one that you were actually there for?
You know, when you show up as a great power, you have to convince folks not just that you have power, but you're there to wield your power for good. And so I think to those in government in those countries who are responsible for governing those countries and leading them, and as I said earlier, there's a lot of history and there's still continuing conflict and tension between some of those governments, and there's, you know, ethnic conflict that goes across borders. So there's a natural tendency to wonder, is the United States here to join one side or the other in those other conflicts and tensions? I think it's a natural suspicion that we find in many places when we come in where it's a complex array of interests and dynamics. So once again, we worked really hard to communicate continually to my partner force commander that, hey, I'm here to find and help you defeat Joseph Kony. And that's what my president has sent me here to do. And we said that not only at my level, but we said that at multiple levels, from the policy level on down, the interagency in the country team and the country team's engagements with each of those governments at our embassies and in their capitals. There was a continual discussion about what our purpose was and what our common objectives were. And I think we all had this sense that, hey, once we conclude this mission of defeating the LRA, the United States will be withdrawing these forces. And certainly at that time, we had many other larger, more pressing security challenges for the United States. So, you know, from our perspective, this was a mission that we could do, and then we could move on.
So, sir, you're no stranger to operational tours or commanding operations. What were some of the differences and unconventionalities between Operation Observant Compass and some of the other operations that you've been a part of? It shows that your commanding expertise came into play in a big way with some of the techniques and tactics of overcoming the vastness and some of the other territorial and landscape challenges that you were presented with.
Yeah, I spoke earlier about the vastness. I mean, I think that's one of the key differences that we had in OOC was the geographical challenges. I mean, Syria and Iraq are minuscule compared to Africa. Perhaps only the expanse of the Indo-PACOM AOR in terms of the challenges we have out there is in some way similar to the challenges we had in Africa. The other thing, though, is the capability of the partner force and their willingness to operate. I was continually impressed at the willingness of all our partners, but primarily the UPDF, the Ugandan Army, their aggression and their commitment to the mission, and their willingness to sacrifice once they got out in the bush to go after the LRA. I found their military professionalism to be very high, and their sense of pride in their as a national army to be deep. And it was a true partnership. We've been in other partnerships, which in where we were frequently the leading more than we were walking alongside our partners. And I can't say that was the case with Ugandan. Certainly we showed up with some capabilities that they didn't possess in their own arsenal, but it was never an issue of desire or professionalism on their part. In fact, I learned quite a bit from my African partner unit commander in a variety of ways.
Yeah, it's great to hear that some of the differences and unconventionalities that you've experienced in Operation Observant Compass compared to some of the other places are on a positive note rather than a challenge that you have to kind of work around. Another question that I have is, did the operation model a top-down or a bottom-up approach? And what do you think seemed most effective?
So tactically, the bottom-up approach was necessary. There was no way you were going to defeat the LRA with a top-down campaign plan that came down from Africa Command in Stuttgart, or even from my headquarters in Entebbe. The LRA was dispersed. They were diffuse. They were hard to find. They were cagey. They had a very sophisticated, even though apparently primitive, communication security structure. They had an operating base that was remote. It was difficult to close the distance with them, to gain and maintain contact with them when a small community was attacked, or where we heard a report of their presence from where we were at the FOBs. So a bottom-up approach was going to be critical for tactical success, getting out into the communities with the African partners, developing relationships, having key leader engagements with local government and local tribal leaders, local religious leaders, to develop a network of partners who would share information and be able to move that information quickly. That was going to be critical. But, you know, at the same time, the top level engagement at my level and higher was critical to keep the coalition solid, to ensure interagency and intergovernmental organization cooperation, and to sustain those field operations that were going on out there at the same time.
Great. And how much would you say your partners, your African partners, played a role in that bottom-up approach?
So the Africans, particularly the Ugandans, contributed the knowledge of the local actors. You know, we're Americans. We weren't there before, the 2012-13, particularly in those areas, very remote areas of Central Africa. As a matter of fact, U.S. Africa Command had a map I saw called the coefficient of basically austereness. And it was like a weather map, and it had these curves on it to show how austere a location was, meaning isolation from infrastructure so they could move logistics. And I noticed that our FOB in Obo, Central African Republic, was under the height of the curve for this map. So you're talking about extremely austere locations where the Ugandans particularly knew the dynamics and knew the players out there. And so they were critical to helping us understand that. You know, what we brought was technological capability. What we brought was logistics to be able to provide them with mobility that could move them long distances at higher speeds. And of course, we brought a sense of legitimacy to international legitimacy to it as well. So that's kind of how we divided it between us and our partners at the tactical level.
And sir, so I know we're talking a lot about the logistics of the mission and trying to get resources, just sustaining your men and your counterparts out there for long periods of time. But you were also talking about working inside an AO that spans throughout multiple countries. So how was it working with multiple ambassadors of these countries and country teams and their counterparts that were assisting you or maybe not assisting you logistically? How did you take that approach?
Yeah, Walton, I got to tell you, beyond working with the great Americans on my team at the command, and being out in the bush on operations with them, this was really the best part of the job. You know, the U.S. has tremendous diplomats who are very, very skilled at effectively engaging with willing partners and frankly, those not so willing, who range from cagey to corrupt to downright dangerous. You know, while soldiers and diplomats serve in different capacities and in different roles, we both share a love of our country, and we all shared in the disgust at what the LRA had done to so many African communities. So I felt a tremendous sense of shared purpose with them. You know, I was privileged to serve with diplomats like Ambassador Scott DeLisi, who led the country team in Uganda during my command. And it was just a wonderful relationship between the country team and my military teammates as well.
That's amazing, sir. Just knowing that like two groups of people have come together for that one mission, and a very moral mission at that, And my question would be, would you have any advice for further commanding officers in a position that they might find themselves in that you did?
Yeah, I mentioned different roles, but a common purpose. And I think that's critical for both diplomat and soldier. It's critical to understand that that there is a difference or a distinction in those roles, but both sides need to deliberately embrace the distinction. You know, when you're a hammer, everything can look like a nail, but of course this isn't true. So you have to learn to appreciate all the tools of national power and how to apply them. That's the key to success in command and the key to success for our nation, frankly. So for future commanders coming into these interagency environments where you're expected not only to pursue a military mission, but to pursue it in a context where you are, you know, closer to the policy dynamics of that mission, then you have to learn how to appreciate those tools of national power and how to work within those frameworks.
So the Lord's Resistance Army, as you've said, was known for brutality and its use of child soldiers. Clearly, the locals and the Ugandan forces had to deal with that for many years. But how did that affect your troops in having to confront child soldiers and some of the tactics that they used?
Well, the special forces soldiers that I worked with were combat veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they had seen plenty of combat and the brutality of it, to include the brutality against civilian non-combatants. So these were not naive men. These Green Berets brought that maturity with them to Africa. And in many ways, I think the operating environment of Africa, being more locally secure, allowed them to do tangible things to improve the lives of the communities around them, to include those of the African partner forces they trained and lived with. So I think that being able to do something in a variety of ways that was good for the local communities, I think helped them deal with it, and frankly to kind of anchor their mission against the LRA. I'll tell you, you know, we had at least one baby born to a family in our Congolese partners that they named after the one of the special forces soldiers in the team out there, because of the help that they had rendered the family.
Wow, it's amazing to hear. And that kind of goes to show some of the character of a lot of these special forces that operate under the U.S. and under your command. On the same note of kind of the effect of fighting against the LRA, did that have any effect on how you operated at all?
Well, I'm a father of four sons and three daughters. And I frequently reflected on how I'd feel if I were unable to protect them from abduction by the LRA, or send them to school, or provide for their welfare because of the insecurity. You know, when you're there and you have the tools to do something about it, you can't help but find motivation for a mission like this.
Absolutely.
So, sir, it sounds like from your vantage point and that of your teams, you had a genuinely a good relationship with the people that you worked with. But on like as your team's relationship, how do they work well with the Ugandan People Defense Force in this matter?
Well, the Ugandans were, as I said before, were very impressive. And I think the first thing that comes to mind is their field craft and hardiness as bush soldiers. You know, you're operating far from home with a level of comfort and support, you know, we would consider on the level of a grubby troop of Boy Scouts, just very few creature comforts. And yet they operated effectively at long distances with little supply in very dangerous situations. And you couldn't help but be impressed by that. Next is the competence of the commanders in counterinsurgency. I mentioned that I learned much from my partner force commanders. You know, Central Africa, like much of the rest of the world, I suppose, is a complex patchwork of ethnic and religious and political dynamics, and some of them not so nice. So I noticed that these commanders had a real appreciation for the realities of regional politics and conflicts and the role that they played in them. And you couldn't help but be impressed. I think perhaps some might go out to an austere location with little infrastructure far, far into the bush and think, hey, somehow there's no sophistication in the way the forces and the state elements are operating out there, because they don't look sophisticated. They lack the shine and polish perhaps of European or Western diplomats. And that nothing could be further from the truth. I think if anything, I learned you know, we share in a common humanity, and their savvy at handling those dynamics out there was just capable as any diplomat in Vienna or anywhere else in the West where we might imagine diplomacy takes place.
Yeah, it's just from my experience alone, when you give people less, they figure out how to do a lot more with less. And I've seen them fix engines with duct tape. I've seen them use scissors to cut pizza. It's astounding what they can just figure out with scissors.
Let me tell you a story about that real quick. So we actually had so our partner force had a contracted airplane flying in some supplies for them in one of our airfields. And one of my air crews heard that, and I won't mention the country, heard that this particular country's aircraft was coming in. It was a contracted airplane. And they said, yeah, we got to back our aircraft into the parking apron, get out of the way. So no joke, as sure as the world, they had backed up our airplane into the parking apron. And this airplane, which was a old Soviet era equivalent of a C-130, came in and didn't even put the brakes on and ran right into the bush. I mean, deep into the jungle and fell right in front of them. And it actually ran into one of our partner forces headquarters camps and wounded four soldiers there. They survived. But you talk about the ingenuity and the resourcefulness of these people who live out there. And this is in Oboe.
Straight tenacity. You know?
What's that?
Straight tenacity. Like it's
no. So here's what happened. So my AOB commander arrives to find the pilot who had survived standing in a puddle of fuel under the wing. And they coax him out of this. And he's smoking a cigarette, of course. And so they coax him out of the puddle. And the people of that village proceeded for the next 3 months to with hammers, no sawzall or no electric tools, proceeded to take apart that whole airplane. And for the next 3 or 4 months, you saw brand new aluminum plates and forks and spoons and knives and accoutrements all over that village from the aluminum they took from that airplane. And it was quite impressive.
And that is something I can definitely imagine. I could definitely see that happen.
I don't blame them.
But with the lessons you learned from working with these groups, because it sounds like you have a very high recommendation towards them, what can you actually, from the lessons you learned with them, how could you take those interactions and use it again in different AOs, in different places around the world?
Yeah, so the first thing you got to do is, what I learned is, you got to become a student of human nature. I think our Western environment, it is so apparently stable. It is so ordered that I think we can be lulled into a sense that nothing is up for grabs. And so everything operates by the rules. And I think until you've been to a culture where you actually have to negotiate the price of something versus going into a store and having the price on a price tag, that was probably my first foray into the realities of negotiating and human nature. I think you just have to, you have to realize that not the whole world doesn't operate the way it seems to where we are. So learn to be a student of human nature, learn to be a realist, meaning be in touch with reality, not what you think is going on, but what's actually happening. And sometimes that's not apparent in cross-cultural situations. So you have to be a keen observer of events and then a student of human nature to figure out what's really happening. And then I think that from there you go to learning the stories on all sides when you're when you enter another's fight. You know, that's part of knowing reality. There's no fight that started with just one side of the story. And so when you show up to help someone resolve a problem, you need to take some time to understand the scope and complexity of the problem itself. I think there's a tendency to frequently amongst Americans to want to oversimplify a problem because we're trying to get straight to a solution. We're fixers, I think, by culture. And some things can't be fixed. They can only be managed. Or at least your partner has become convinced over a long period of time that it can only be managed. And so their expectations are probably for progress are much lower than ours are when we arrive. Americans are very sanguine and optimistic about the future. Other cultures are shaped by their geography and history to be less optimistic about things. And so you have to take all those things into account when you show up in a situation like Central Africa, or frankly, many of the other conflict-ridden areas where we are operating. And then finally, you need to be a student of what your partner force's motivations are, what their restrictions are, and you need to moderate your expectations accordingly. It doesn't mean you don't pursue progress or pursue the mission. It just means you take them into account as you try to develop your plan for achieving your mission.
No, I really like that comment. It's just studying human nature and just kind of realizing that something that might be a given to you is not a given to them. Something that's a given to them is not a given to you. That knowledge of how, like, if you were born and bred and this is how things are done or not done, like, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around, like, trying to explain it differently and not just sticking to your way, believing your way is the way.
I mean, even on like small issues, like, so one of my partner commanders, you know, he lost two or three siblings to AIDS, and he was commanding a force. And so they had AIDS prevention training every week in their organization because there was still a high incidence of AIDS infection. Whereas in America, you know, we think we've largely defeated that disease, or now we have, you know, medicines and antiretroviral drugs, and they do too, but it was a personal thing with them. That's not a part of my experience. And there was a deep fear by a lot of Ugandan soldiers, for example, that they would die out in the bush and they would be left there. We don't have that feeling in the United States military, right? We invest large amounts of resources to assure our diplomats and our military personnel, and frankly, American citizens writ large, that if you get into a bind, the United States is going to come get you. And we're going to repatriate you alive if we can, and we'll risk Americans' lives to do that. And then if we can't save you alive, then we will bring your remains home. I mean, look, we have Operation Full Accounting still going on to account for all of our MIA and KIA from previous wars. You know, they don't have programs like that. So understanding where they're coming from is critical to being able to operate.
Great note, sir.
I agree. And I think it's important. You mentioned a lot of things about just being mindful and observant. And I think a lot of people get kind of bogged down in some of their own, I guess, ideals and kind of not opening up about other people's circumstances, which is important. And I think that you covered that pretty well. So Operation Observant Compass utilized a lot of PSYOPs and information operations to a great effect. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. So as I said, I had a PSYOPs detachment of 4th Psychological Operations Group in Fort Bragg. This captain and his team of 7 or 8 soldiers there, and they worked with the local communities in northern Uganda to understand the Acholi narrative and to understand the dynamics of the Acholi culture vis-a-vis the history of Uganda. And then they studied the LRA itself and what drove them and as much as we understood about them. Then they studied the Central African communities that were being victimized by the LRA. For example, the Imroro tribesmen who are roving herders across Africa, seasonally moving their herds north to south, and to understand how they thought about the LRA and their engagements with them. And then they would produce tailored products, both leaflets and print, as well as radio transmissions and programs to speak to those audiences, right? As I said, to both convince the LRA to give up and to defect and leave the LRA and come home, as well as to steal the resolve of the African communities and to create situational awareness and to create a sense of shared struggle so that they could combine their resources and knowledge to defend themselves against the LRA. That was very effective. I think another level is they helped us understand in their studies of the regions, you know, in our key leader engagements, understanding what the agendas were of all the local leaders, local religious leaders, local military leaders, and as a commander would go out and speak with these leaders, or as many of the leaders of our SF teams would go talk to these regional leaders, what to say. And then also we would combine that with certain services we could provide if it was, whether it was just presence to give legitimacy to the African Union Task Force from an international perspective, or whether it was providing medical capability demonstration, for example, in a village where we could come in and treat some people of a particular, you know, illnesses that were easy for us to do alongside our partner forces. The messaging plus those activities combined together to produce an influence that I think increased the resolve of the communities in Central Africa. And then, you know, we had a very, very high defection rate while we were there. We brought out, you know, some 200 or so LRA defectors but many of them women and children. But we also brought out some LRA combatants. So that's how that worked.
And during your time there, you captured the LRA Deputy Commander Dominic Ongwin. Could you explain or at least elaborate on that or how that went down?
So Central African Republic at that time was divided in a religious ethnic conflict between a group called the Seleka, who had rebelled against the central government, and the Anti-Balaka, which were the opposite side of that conflict. And it had become quite violent, and both on a communal level as well as a military level. And the Seleka essentially were controlling the extreme north and eastern parts of Central African Republic up around the Kafia Kingi area where the LRA had retreated to. You know, for reasons that are still unclear, but perhaps it was to curry favor with the U.S., Seleka wanted to hand Dominic Ongwin over to us. He walked into their hands, and so we through our interlocutors got word of this, and they said they had somebody important. So of course we didn't know who it was, but we were interested in going up and taking a look. So I hand selected a 2-man special forces team and sent them up there to conduct negotiations with the Seleka rebels. And when they got up there, they took custody of Dominic Ongwin and didn't really know who he was. And on the way back, they had him in the airplane. They knew he was a Acholi because he looked a Acholi. On the airplane, they wrote down on a pad of paper, "Who are you?" and handed him the pad of paper. And he wrote, "I am Dominic Ongwin," and handed it back. And that pad is now framed in the 10th Special Forces Group headquarters in the company room of that SF company.
Wow.
You know, Ongwin's delivery to the ICC instead of our Ugandan partner complicated our mission. You can imagine how the Ugandans had hoped he was a citizen of Uganda, and they considered themselves to have legitimate jurisdiction over his case, and that certainly induced some friction between us and our partner force. But that was a policy level decision beyond my authority to affect at that time.
Yeah, that's from their point of view. I could see how that might be quite a bit insulting. But so by the time you left. I know you already discussed about the capturing of Dominic Ongwin and then the defectors that were coming out in the hundreds. By the time that you left, could you explain the composition and the strength of the LRA by then?
So estimates varied, but none were over a few hundred. You know, some folks would say 1,000. We never saw indications of that large of a force, even though, I mean, 1,000 people in an AO the size of California, certainly you could spread out and be pretty hard to see. We just didn't have – none of the intelligence I was receiving was convincing, you know, that they had a force of that size. So I had estimated in 2015 when I left they were no more than 200 to at a max 300. You know, in Kony – by that time, he was personally hemmed up in a very, very remote area in northwestern South Sudan and northeastern Kar called Kafia Kingi, a very inhospitable region right on the southern edge of the desert, essentially. The territory in northern Kar and northern South Sudan begins to become very arid unless you're in the middle of South Sudan and the Nile River marshes that feed the Nile. It starts to become very, very dry and not a very nice place to live. You know, he's got, he had little support and he was far away from his previous victims. So I agree with the assessments at the conclusion of Observant Compass that, you know, Kony is now irrelevant to the future of Central Africa and he will die if he's not dead yet, alone, sick and defeated, which is a small justice for all the victims that he predated upon. But certainly for future generations of Central Africans, he will not be a threat. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you just summed up how the success of Operation Observant Compass kind of what you walked away from it is being a success, at least. Can you talk about how the tenets of this operation can be utilized and duplicated in other conflicts and regions around the world?
In one sense, it's difficult because it was such a small operation on a small scale. But to go back to some of the principles I've mentioned earlier, those are still applicable no matter the scale. And that's build partnerships on common interests and realistic objectives, and then have milestones about how to measure your progress. We spent a lot of time talking with our African partners about where we felt we were in the campaign and what was achievable and what wasn't, given the situation, given the amount of logistics capacity, given the amount of intelligence capacity that we had. And I think that's the key for the other areas where we're operating against various adversaries today. Build partnerships on common interests, realistic objectives, and go after those objectives with a lot of passion.
Yes, I completely agree. And on that note, what can the U.S. policymakers and diplomats glean from the success and the failures of Operation Observant Compass?
So OOC is a good example on a small scale, as I said, of how the tools of national power can be wielded effectively. And despite claims to the contrary, very, very cheaply. In the scheme of things, OOC was very small, very cheap, if you think about the size of the defense budget. We were very careful to husband the resources we had and use them in the most effective way we could. And I think we did that. You know, the military in general and special operations forces especially are also not the solution to every national security challenge. When there is a military role, though, OOC shows that the DOD knows how to play on a very effective team. And I mentioned the interagency relationships. I've seen that model of teamwork replicated in a lot of places. And I think we've learned over the last 20 years of combat operations how to work with the interagency, you know, in a very effective way. So policymakers and diplomats in the future should look at that closely. In terms of failures, I mean, OOC succeeded in removing the threat of the LRA. Did we get Joseph Kony? No, we didn't get him. And there are reasons for that that perhaps will come to light later. But that certainly wasn't a failure. The LRA is no longer a threat. So the objectives of OOC were achieved. If there were any difficulties, I think they were primarily rooted in how to determine what level of resourcing amidst competing priorities for a nation that was at war in various locations at the time. But I don't think you're ever going to fully resolve that. Prioritization is always going to be difficult when resources are scarce. And frankly, I'm not just talking about equipment and fuel. I'm talking about very specialized and well-trained forces that are needed elsewhere. One could question the length of time it took to achieve the objectives of OOC. You know, we spent several years doing that, but I think that's on a very American clock. You know, particularly in counterinsurgency, you know, the enemy, well, in every conflict, the enemy gets a vote, and sometimes the enemy owns you own the clock, but the enemy owns the time. You know, in an area as large as we were operating with the size of force we had, I think we in general did the best with the time we had.
Thank you, sir. Is there anything else you would like to say about this operation, or anything you'd like the listeners to know?
Well, I'll just say, I miss Africa every day, and I consider it the highlight of my career to have served alongside both my own countrymen in the State Department and the various country teams, and as well as my comrades in the U.S. military who were out there in the bush, and those who were supporting them back in Entebbe, and as well as my African partners, and we were all together on such a noble effort. That was a career highlight. So I really appreciate Liam, you and Walton letting me come on this podcast today, and let me share that with you.
Sir, it's been a pleasure of ours. We thank you for coming on here, and we thank you for everything that you've done for this country and even for the people of Uganda and around the world.
Yes, sir. We can't thank you enough. LoboCast is very thankful. Clearly, you're very experienced. It's so awesome to hear that this meant so much to you. Because living in the EA, it's a beautiful place, you know, a place often left out of discussion, but I think this does shed a little light on its beauty and what it has to offer and these nations that are upcoming. So everything you said, sir, it's we're just very thankful that you came on LoboCast today.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I wish you two the best.